There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host. It's my pleasure to welcome Adrian Bijan to the show today to talk about his new book, Time and Beauty: Why Time Flies and Beauty Never Dies. Adrian Bijan is the J.A. Jones Distinguished Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Duke University. In his works, he applies physics to explain everyday phenomena that aren't traditionally tied to physics. Adrian Bijan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very, very pleased to be talking to you today.
Before we get started discussing your book, tell us about some of the influences on your intellectual development.
Wow. you are the first to ask me these questions. The answer begins with my parents and the times of my childhood. I was born in 1948, raised under communism, which was a challenge for those who were free thinkers and who wanted to be left alone. And so the whole street was like the home in which I was raised, one where the culture in the home was European, or you may say Occidental, or cosmopolitan, out there in the street, meaning the regime was instituting something very, very different. So this this two-sided portrayal of reality was a constant source of questioning in my mind. And that's basically the origin of my my way of thinking. The pals, I like to call them hoodlums, I was playing with, were behaving the same way. Coincidentally, most of them were Jewish and left in 1961. We were passing books, old books, over the fence. Meaning we were sharing books from the previous period, you know, the great books that you hear about in the West. And so, once again, reading was a coin with two facets, the unofficial and then, of course, the imposed one. So this dichotomy, which called for comparison, everyday comparison, and questioning which side is true, was very, very useful. So that was my background and my surroundings, and frankly, the reason why I grew up poised to do the best that I can.
And so then, you come by the ability to be a scientist who is able to grapple with a subject that has fascinated poets and philosophers for generations. And I'll admit to sharing that fascination. The questions that you deal with, let's start with the first one. Why does time feel like it passes more quickly the older we get? What is it about that phenomenon that fascinated you?
Well, it fascinated me in retrospect. Growing up, I observed many things. I can get into the frustrating observation that made me appreciate the phenomenon of evolution. So evolution, I was raised as a basketball player, and I was frustrated that I was not getting better faster. So that's an evolutionary design observation that stayed with me. In fact, that motivates me to this day. The perception of time and the fact that time flies faster as we get older, That was one of my early observations in everything I was doing. For example, in school, in the fifth grade, which was the beginning of middle school, I felt during exam hours that the hour was shorter, definitely shorter than in elementary school. And then year after year, especially in high school, it was pretty obvious that the time was flying already, meaning that I had to be really good during the exam hour because I would not have extra time to redo the problem if I got it wrong the first time. So this was, of course, accentuated by my experience as a player. The older I, meaning the bigger I got, the shorter the game was. Meaning the clock was forcing me to be very careful with doing something useful during the finite number of minutes, and. So these are the early impressions. And then through my life, obviously the education I received at MIT, the same sort of observation persisted, but it was not a bothersome observation because it was obvious. And I kept hearing from my elders, life is short, and all these words of wisdom that we know very, very well. And then I do not know how it happened or why. About 4 years ago, I said, hey, wait a minute. This impression that is so common, it must have a basis in physics, which should be easy to explain. And then I sat down and I wrote a letter to myself, which became a journal publication in March 2019. And I wrote that for fun. The prediction actually that yes, the perception of time should be that time flies faster as we get older. And then to my huge surprise, I got an email from an outfit that counts the number of clicks on a particular publication that appears in a journal. Mine was the most clicked on article in the whole world in the March of 2019. The second most clicked was way, way, way far behind with less than half the number of thousands of clicks that my paper had gotten. And
well,
then I said, oh, I said, Adrian, the whole world is worried about getting older, okay?
That's right. I was just about to say that. That time is the water we swim in. And yes, everyone's worried about, or at least aware of, getting older. And the other subject, the concept that you deal with is another big one. That's beauty. So tell us, why are we attracted to beauty?
Well, this was a coincidence. After I read this explanation for, meaning predictive statement on why time should be flying faster, the explanation itself, if we get into the details, turns out to be this the same physics, the same mechanism that's responsible for the feeling of attractiveness. We're attracted to certain things. Of course, we migrate towards those things unwittingly. And I use the example of images everywhere. What the visual field offers us is a two-dimensional image, like the screen at a cinema or the computer. Well, that image, in this case, it's made by people. That image happens to be just like the business card and the banknote and the flag of a nation, meaning somewhat longer horizontally than in the vertical direction. Well, that's the same, I call it aspect ratio, of the rectangle that's that approximates the binocular field of vision of the two-eyed animal, including the human. And then I had 2 years earlier, I had figured out that this preference for this shape, basically the shape of almost everything we look at, comes from the fact that we have two eyes, and the other fact, which is that the world is flat, meaning there's a horizon on it. Everything is and moves and lives, everything from animals to treetops and apartment buildings. And this image, this shape, the business card shape, is the a rectangular image that is scanned by the two eyes the fastest. And so, as I said, about 10 years earlier, I had figured out that the viewing is, first of all, scanning. The eyes are jiggling, meaning the fovea moving all over in two dimension on all over this particular area. And for the mind to make sense of the message that comes from the image, to make sense faster, so that the animal gets the idea and gets out of the way of danger faster, that is good for the animal. And from this, the attractiveness of an image that is that communicates the message faster. And so I arrive at the feeling of attractiveness, and then obviously every one of us knows that feeling, and it's a very short road from this aha to the word beauty, because in the art gallery, if you look at on the wall, almost all the tremendous paintings, famous paintings, are shaped the same way. Everything we look at is looks just like the business card or like the computer screen.
So let me make sure I understand what you're saying. We are attracted to beauty, at least in part, because of the fundamental reality that we have two eyes on the horizontal plane, and visual images that are, let's say, easy to process, easy to grasp, are ones that attract us. And if they are difficult to grasp or to scan, then we find them less attractive, even aversive. And all of that is basically to facilitate the things we need to do to stay alive. Is that correct?
We are attracted to certain things because they are good for us. Never mind the word beauty. You see, this is an example of where language gets in the way. We're attracted to objects and phenomena that are good for us. I could include here sounds, rhythms, you know, marching music, if you want, or a symphony. The things that are good for us are attractive, and certainly. Now that we're talking about images, certain shapes. Well, I was trained in the graphic arts as well, and certain shapes that are better than other shapes go by the name of proportions. Well, we've heard of proportions, or an image being well proportioned, a human face being proportioned, or some other thing being with balance. And in other words, a thing not being out of shape. And these many, many words that take us all over the landscape of imagery, including the human body and the human face and the human stride and the walk and the dance and all these other things. So the word beauty is just one word that is not restricted to faces out of Hollywood. Beauty is a word that became, how should I say, the face of a much wider and diverse menagerie of attractive objects, images, sounds, flavors, tastes, smells, you know, the feeling of touching something. You see, so the scientific little voice in me says, Adrian, look at the big picture. You know, you like something. Be honest. You actually be honest with yourself. You like many things, but why do you like these many things that are at first impression different? Different. Well, I like to say different. Yes, obviously they're different, but different does not mean unrelated or not coming of the same mother, you see. And the mother is physics, the mother meaning the reality of everything that is correct. That's the meaning of the word physics. Everything that is around us, inside of us, behind us in time and in the future. Physics.
So let's go back to time and the experience of it moving faster or more slowly. Tell us a little about the physics of that.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm very happy to see that you began with beauty, because that was earlier, and it alerted me to the fact that the eyes are scanning the image. I already knew that scanning is a very important kind of motion. It means moving on an area, for example, pedestrian movement in the city. I had figured out even before the beauty, the physics of beauty, why an airport such as the Atlanta airport must be or should have been shaped like the business card, okay? A little bit longer in the fast direction, which is that of the train, than in the transversal direction, which is that of the concourses. And so scanning is the movement. Scanning is the physics. And And so explanation for why time should fly faster as we're getting older comes from the fact that the perception of time, and here I limit the discussion to one example, which is that of vision, meaning looking at things and perceiving images, activity of the organ of vision, which is the human eye, is scanning. The eyes are scanning the image, and they are doing it in abrupt, violent jolts of the eyeball, called saccade. Saccade really means all the way to dangerous kick, and these saccades are very very frequent. They're about from 3 to 5 per second. They are separated, so the eye moves abruptly to a new position, and then it stays in that position for 1/3 or 1/5 of a second. That position of stationary look is called fixation. And in other words, the eye is photographing, okay, the image in the sequential clicks. This is a metaphor for the reality that, contrary to the common impression that what we look at is a smoothly running continuous movie, no, just like in the cinema, what is there on the screen of the binocular field of vision is a sequence of clicks, a sequence of what do you call these things? Frames on the celluloid tape, so the tape is running at a particular speed that corresponds to the muscular action, meaning the movement of the eyes. And from this comes the aha. Uh-huh. Well, if there's movement, in this case the movement of the eyes, these jolts, then there's a frequency of these things, meaning that let's talk about a fixed period of clock time from sunrise to sunset, which is a fixed for everybody on Earth, a particular day of the year. Then during that fixed clock time, the brain receives a certain number of impressions. Okay? So that's the end of the physics, except that the camera, the living person, is getting older over time. The infant in the crib, I think mothers know this best. The infant has eyes that are basically jiggling all the time and scanning everything in all directions, upward from the crib. And so the brain, which in fact is taking shape, most of it is grows and becomes what it is in infancy, gets used to to receiving a large number of clicks during a finite period of clock time, a large number of clicks. With the aging, that is, first with body growth, the length of the path of transmission of the signal from any organ, such as the eye, to the brain increases. So the distance increases with the age. The shape of that particular conduit becomes more complex with bifurcations and ramifications and increasing complexity, meaning street corners to be gone around. And with aging, of course, the flow of anything through any duct in the human body slows down. because of many effects, degradation, and other items of bad news that come with age. And another one is the fact that with age, which also brings about the phenomenon of fatigue, the speed or the frequency of muscular action decreases. Big bodies move at a lower frequency. You see this in the legs of elephant versus the legs of the mouse. But that's only half of the story. Bigger things, older things, move slower and slower. You see this in the legs of, say, soccer players. Soccer players after the age of 32, 33, lose a step or two in the race to the goal or to defend the goal. So all these things, a longer path to be traveled by the signal from the organ to the brain, and a lower speed. This is what happens with age. All that means that from sunrise to sunset, the brain receives fewer and fewer images. And the brain, of course, tells the owner of the brain that about the feeling that the sunset arrived too soon. The future of every single one of us is this feeling that the new year arrives too soon, or that the 4th of July arrived too soon, or it's winter again. Winter was yesterday. All these feelings stem from the physics of animal design. That's actually the correct name for this particular kind of physics, animal design.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Let's shift away from animals for a moment and just look at something that was not a main focus of the book, but it got my attention. You wrote the following sentence: science came as an add-on to religion. Both are artifacts, both adopted to make life, movement, easier, safer, and long-lasting. Now, I think it's easy for anyone listening to see why science helps make life easier, safer, and longer lasting. But how do you see religion as a pre-science that did the same thing?
Well, all you have to, if the answer is not self-evident, then let me draw attention to the Ten Commandments. Those are rules of, not rules, but advice from a higher authority. That is the way it is given. It's a commandment of how to live a safer life, a better life for the immediate group that is around you, starting with your family, with your elders, with the community at large. You take every single commandment, and it is about that. Those are words of wisdom that have their origin in empiricism, meaning in the observation of what is good, and what is good for the human being, and those who have not been introduced to the Ten Commandments would do better to get to know them, regardless of the name of the particular belief. In fact, I talk to students, they come from all sorts of directions, all sorts of cultures, and most of them have the Ten Commandments in their upbringing, but others do not, but in their own way, say from the Far East, have a similar rules of, let's call them wisdom, that that society or any individuals live by because it is good for them. Well, that is, of course, religion, why it is embraced universally, even by those who proclaim that they are not religious. I don't believe such proclamations. I just look at the way people live and how they treat each other. It's basically in this line of thinking, which is that there are certain ways in which movement on the surface of the earth becomes better and better for the individual and for those around the individual, meaning that it's not just one, but the organization around that person, called a niche in animal design, benefits from certain features. I call them, once again, design. Actually, I call them constructal design. These rules are not constraints. They are actually the lubricant that propels us more and more easily in life. And so that is religion. Well, change the words and you end up with a very accurate description of science. You began by saying that with science, the the need for this kind of artifact called science is obvious. Yes, but there's nothing new in that. And this is why science is the, let's say, the more recent extension, if you want, to religion. And yes, I wrote in the book that religion with science is a more powerful artifact than science without religion or religion without science.
You also mention the issue of scientific plagiarism in the book. You mentioned it briefly. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the impact of ChatGPT and its related approaches on that issue?
Well, the answer is horrible. That's the impact. This software you mentioned is the latest alarm bell that's being rung. The plagiarism, which is a plague, by the way, plagiarism and plague have the same origin in Greek, an origin that's pretty clear about the danger in it. The plagiarism became a pandemic because of the internet. That happened for three decades now. That's been happening and getting out of control. The message to my own career is that what I have discovered and published is so good that I'm being plagiarized almost every day with impunity. By professional plagiarists. And so I became curious about the phenomenon. And yes, it's for those who cannot create, then it is much, much easier to steal. This is basically the very old observation that's also one of the points in the Ten Commandments. And
a recent article in Nature just on that issue, well, related to it, Noted that there's a growing shortage of peer reviewers for scientific journals. So, and they also noted the growing number of errors found in papers that have been published. So it seems like a kind of perfect storm, or maybe I misunderstand that ChatGPT and no peer review, few peer reviewers, and plagiarism being widespread because of the internet. Do you see that all coming together and degrading the process of science?
Sure. That's what you mentioned is accurate and predictable. When you have let's call it a technology of so-called scientific research and then publishing that has become really inexpensive and at everybody's fingertips, then you have the situation where where everybody writes and publishes and nobody reads. That's basically what's going on. There's been an explosion in the number of journals, scientific journals. Universities are boasting about the knowledge industry, which is nonsense. It's really nonsense. You cannot have knowledge as an industry in the same way that the child that's born or the idea that occurs in the mind of an individual is a product that is produced by an industrial complex. That's not the case. The strike of lightning, the flash in the mind, is extremely rare. It is precious, and it belongs to one person, not to an industrial plant. And so this is what's become in publishing. Nature, by the way, contributes to this itself. Compared with articles in Nature, say 100 years ago, when one individual published one idea, and you knew the event, you knew the name of the creator. Now, Nature publishes articles with 36 authors, in other words, zero personality, if you want, but also you don't know whose idea it is. And of course, it takes a lot of money to produce one of these articles that the top journals applaud. Another way to summarize this description is that it's become a Tower of Babel, the so-called publishing industry. The authors worth their name shy away from this sort of bedlam for many reasons. One is that they are not the kind of author to co-author anything with 35 people, number one. But the other one is the fact that when you enter this kind of pigsty, you get eaten by the pigs. That's the peasant way of putting it, meaning that you submit an idea and you have no idea what happens to your idea because of the internet. It could be plagiarized and republished by somebody else instantly. That is the problem with the speed of publishing in the internet era.
Adrian, let's circle back to time because our time is running low. You recommend change, variety in everything from daily routine on to every other aspect of life as a way of making time feel like it moves more slowly. And that makes sense. At the same time, various traditional cultures suggest other successful ways, for example, meditation, within a very highly ritualized structure. And in fact, just yesterday, Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein dealt with the issue that we're talking about. And one of the things that she recommended was that people try to experience awe very often, because the experience of awe slows down the perception of time. What are your thoughts about all this?
I did not understand the experience of what?
Awe, A-W-E. When you look at the Grand Canyon, yeah.
Sure, yeah, well, I'm aware of this article because it was sent to me by three of my readers, shocked that this particular author, Elizabeth Bernstein, did not mention my work. That is why I know about her. And that brings up, once again, the previous point that I was making, that because of the internet, it is easy for a person to get an idea to retell the story of the third and last portion of my book, which is which includes this particular recommendation. I talk about the fact that awe is what we experience when we witness a soccer game that is full of unbelievable plays or unexpected victory for our favorite team, or for like Miracle on Ice in the hockey game of from Lake Placid, and on and on. And yes, those things are moments, I call it in the book, when we experience the feeling that time has stopped, you see, which is the opposite of time flying faster and faster. And that third part of my book is recommending to people to expose themselves to unusual circumstances, different circumstances that punctuate life. And I also made the point that truly creative people are those who do new things pretty much every day, who, in fact, they say, aha, quite frequently when they come up with new ideas. And but these are the individuals I know best, because that I'm one of them. Okay.
Finally, Adrian, you've written a book for a general audience that integrates physics with cognitive science with evolutionary psychology. It's a big challenge. What impact do you hope your book will have?
Well, I'll answer that, first, my view of the subject that this recent work of mine is opening up is that it teaches that human perceptions, which before my work were considered to be intangibles, meaning out of the reach of the laws of thermodynamics, are in fact predictable, meaning they belong in physics. Human perceptions, in this book, the perception of beauty, which is really attractiveness, and then the perception of time, which, by the way, is the perception of change, because these clicks the frames on the movie tape they convey to the brain the occurrence of change. If the image is still, meaning if the piece of art is lifeless, then the brain where the image goes blank, meaning the eyes don't see anything anymore. So time. The perception of time is the perception of change. And the other name for a change after change in a perceptible direction is evolution. And so we have, at the end of this brief conversation, this big word, evolution, long word, in physics. in physics, the science of everything that is, which includes, of course, animal life and also river life and atmosphere life, or climate, if you want, and everything else that changes in a perceptible direction. And that is a big thing to recognize that evolution is not only universal as a phenomenon, but it is predictable.
The book is Time and Beauty, Why Time Flies and Beauty Never Dies. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Adrian.
Thank you, Renee. I appreciate it.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.